You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
Worf, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to The Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek The Next Generation. Tonight's episode is Final Mission, and I'm Melissa from Nebraska.
And I'm James from London.
And I'm Lou from Nebraska. Wait, someone else is from Nebraska? No, you're not. She's lying, guys. She actually lives in Fargo, North Dakota, but she is on a mission that was extended way beyond the way what it was supposed to. But why don't you tell a story, Melissa? Why are you in Nebraska?
Well, let's just say that it's very coincidental that we're discussing an episode today about a shuttle. I was on my way to Nebraska, but way back on the 5th of this month, and I crashed into a deer along Interstate 80, which is this road that goes all the way across the state of Nebraska. It's a wonderfully exciting drive.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, and I was just outside of a nice town called North Platte, which was about 2 hours from where I was wanting to end up. Mm-hmm. And a deer jumped right out in front of my car about 10 o'clock at night. And $7,000 in damage later, I'm stuck in this lovely corner of Nebraska until the 22nd. So it was supposed to be a 4 or 5 day trip, and it turned into almost a 3 week trip. But I'm really getting a taste for the state, and Nebraska is a lovely place. If you don't count the rattlesnakes and the heat and the humidity. So it's a great place to be. So here I am in Nebraska, but normally, yes, I am from North Dakota.
So obviously you came down I-29.
Yep.
Okay.
And then went over the north end of Omaha and down into Lincoln and then onto I-80 from there. So.
Oh, so you went out 680.
Yep.
Okay, so yeah, you bypassed I-80 and then, yeah, so you go 29 to 680, that brings you around the north end. And then out west Omaha, it turns into I-80 west.
Right.
So, yeah. Well, when you go back, then, because you had said something like, you know, you thought of me when you came through, and I said, well, gee, when you drive back, I'd like to, you know, meet up with you or something. Just swing by and say hi, because it'd be fun to do. I remember.
I would love to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. We went to Chicago a couple years back. I don't know if I've even told anybody about this, but we went to Chicago a couple years back to see the One Direction concert. Mm-hmm. And that's my daughter's – well, was my daughter saying, believe it or not, she took all our fathead down from One Direction. So I think they probably broke up and now the love is over. We were about 30 minutes away from Ben Straw. I don't know if either of you even know him, but he was another podcaster. No. Him and Byer Brown were really good friends of mine on podcasting. So it's like, it would have been a sin to not go visit Ben. So, you know, that was fun. So when you go through, you let me know. Do you have my phone number?
I do not. You're going to have to, you should put that in the chat box for me and I will put it in my cell phone and I will give you a call. I should put my, so you'll know when I'm calling who this weird number is. This is me. Yeah, definitely. It would be great. Hopefully, I'm hoping that I will be going through there. I'm hoping it'll be around lunchtime. But it honestly it depends on when they decide my car is done.
You bet.
I told Katie, the gal I'm staying with, that I said, I don't care what time the car gets done. I'm heading home that day. So.
Right.
So we'll see.
Right.
We'll But it will be fun to get home. So.
Okay. That'd be nice. Yeah, just let me know what's happening, and I'll meet you somewhere out by 680, so you don't have to deviate too much.
That would be great.
So yeah, I think there's a pizza place out there called Uncle Matteo's, and what they have is it's almost like a Subway sandwich shop type place.
Really?
Where yeah, you come in, you tell what they want, to you pull out this little 6-inch or 9-inch pizza, they put it on there, put it in the oven, and it nuclearizes it for, you know, 2, 3, 4 minutes, and then it comes out, and it's really cool. So that'd be a good spot for you.
Yes, I would love to.
Okay, so
we'll do that.
Yes, we had talked about five minutes before the show, because I was racking my brain trying to remember when we had you on the show last, and apparently we've never had you on the show.
It's true.
That is sad to hear, and I'm sorry about that, because I've been on the Delta Quadrant, I've been on the Upper Pylon, but not to have you on the Battle Bridge. I'm sorry, but we'll make sure you get on more often.
Oh, well, thank you.
So tell us what you are doing with the Upper Pylon 2. Where has it been lately, and how's that going?
Well, as you know, I started podcasting with the Delta Quadrant years ago now. And we got to the end of the mission. The ship got home. So, so we were wrapping up. And, gosh, it wasn't probably even a week after the Delta Quadrant had ended. And podcasting has just really been a great hobby for me. And I just really didn't want to let it go. And so about a week after, I put something up on the forums on TrekMate and said, you know, I think I would like to start a podcast to review Deep Space Nine. And now, of course, there was formerly another podcast on TrekMate that had been going through Deep Space Nine, and they had been on hiatus for quite some time. And so I talked to Mark and made sure that it was okay for us to go ahead and do this. And I immediately had a number of volunteers who said that they were willing to give it a try. And so I very gently nudged and convinced them to jump into it with me, and Upper Pylon 2 began a little over a year ago. Actually, we had our 1 year anniversary, almost 2 months ago now, because it was the end of May that we released our first show. And so we are currently about halfway through, a quarter to a halfway through season 3 of Deep Space Nine. And of course, you know, it's just, the show's just getting really good. The hardest part, I think, about doing a Deep Space Nine podcast is you have to find something other to say than, oh my gosh, that was wonderful. Or, oh, I love this. Or, oh, I love that. But we do, you know, we always manage to find other things to talk about. And we've even managed to find more than a few things to critique along the way. So it's been a lot of fun. I have a great new cast, Matthew Smonsky, Blair Donnelly, and Chris Johnson, all were former guests of the Delta Quadrant, actually, and people who had written in and feedback and been active on the forums. And so it was great that that's kind of how they came into the family. And then also, shortly after we got started, Matt Hansen, who ran the Delta Quadrant, actually, asked if he could join Upper Pylon 2. And so he's been with us for these first few seasons, although as I had mentioned to you in speaking earlier, he is actually probably going to be going on a hiatus to some extent as he begins law school this fall. So we're really excited for him to do that. And we'll just kind of see where it goes from there. But yeah, we're having a great time. It's been a lot of fun. And I'm looking forward to the next 4 seasons with these guys. So that's kind of where that's at.
Wow. Matt is a lawyer.
It's a scary thought, isn't it?
Oh, I got a feeling he'd win a lot of cases. Just sheer arguing the cases would probably win him some.
You know, I wouldn't want to be on the other side of him. Mm-mm. I'll say that.
No, absolutely not. Especially since he's got an encyclopedic knowledge of Star Trek. But now I guarantee he'll have one of the law. I got a feeling he'll be able to pull out precedences out of his head.
Yeah.
So that is pretty awesome. Well, yeah, we've had Chris on a few times. We've had Blair on, and I think I've got Matt scheduled somewhere around here, but yeah, later. Good. So, and then we finally got you on, but I don't think we've had Smotsky on.
No, I don't know that Smotsky has done any other podcasts, and he is quite the busy guy. He does research, and his job kind of goes through phases where I know he works 12-hour days for weeks at a time. So,
oh boy,
yeah, it is tough to get to him. But they are just a wonderful group of guys. It's been so much fun getting to know them better, and you know, if any of them ever, you know, doesn't behave themselves on their show, you just let me know and I'll take care of it. So
I've never had an issue. But you know what'd be interesting is by the time we get done with the Next Generation, we've already discussed about going on to Deep Space Nine, and I'm sure you've heard us lovingly refer it to as Lower Pylon 2, because we'll never be as, you know, you guys will always be above us there in Upper Pylon 2. So, but it's going to be fascinating if we get you on, say, season 1 of DS9 as you're somewhere around season 6 or 7 yourself. So that would be fascinating to have on.
Mm-hmm. That would be a lot of fun.
So,
and, you know, there can never be too many podcasts. I think that because every time that you get a different group of people together, you get a different perspective. And so much of what we enjoy about Star Trek has to do with what's going on in our own lives as we enjoy it, you know, because it speaks to us in different ways, as any good story does. So mm-hmm. Yeah, the more the merrier. The synopsis for tonight's show is, on his way to Starfleet Academy, Wesley Crusher must care for an injured Captain Picard after their shuttle crashes on a desert moon. This is the 9th episode of Season 4 of Star Trek The Next Generation. The original release date was November 19th, 1990. It was written by Casey Arnold Ince and directed by Corey Allen. Our guest stars include Nick Tate as Dirgo, Kim Hamilton as Sonji, Mary Conard as Tess Allenby, and, of course, Majel Barrett as the voice of the computer. So what do we think about this episode?
You first. Ladies first.
You first.
You first.
This was always a favorite episode of mine. I never really felt any of that Wesley Crusher ambivalence that a lot of fans did at the time. I was 8 years old when the show started, so he was slightly older than I was. So, you know, watching it first run, he was the teenager that I, you know, would have loved to have been when I grew up. Mm. So I just overall, this is kind of a heartwarming episode for me. I loved the stuff between Wesley and Captain Picard, and I think they did a good job of writing it, and I think it comes off really well.
Mm. Okay. I kind of agree. I have been a downer on Wesley. Brian and I came up with a couple hundred ways to kill Wesley Crusher. But I think he was used very good in this episode, and it's nice to see him go out like this.
It was. It was a very nice, this was a great way for him to transition out of the regular cast, I think.
Yep. So, but it's certainly not the end of Wesley. We don't say goodbye forever. He just has to go study, study, study.
Exactly.
Or as Worf would say, learn, learn, learn. Okay. Doctor, what about you?
Okay, I don't want to, like, be a downer here. But I think I'm going to be a downer. I'm not entirely in love with this episode. I think that there are a few things that happen in the episode that I think are stupid, and it starts from the oh let's go on a shuttle for no reason other than the fact that it can fail, and I have a problem with some of the scenes in this episode and the stupidity of the crew. I suppose I'm not a Wesley hater. I don't particularly didn't particularly kind of warm to the character on the first run, but I think as we've been watching, I don't think he's anywhere near as bad as what the consensus or at least the haters out there might have put across. I just didn't really care that much for this episode in general, and I thought that the scenario that they like landed in was somewhat forced. But I'll leave it there until I can complain about Newton's first law in due course.
So we talked about why Will Wheaton was leaving the show. He was wanting to do things, and the producers were blocking him, it seems. Mm-hmm. Do you think the show is better with him or without him?
Gosh, you know, for me, that's tough to say, because honestly, when I was watching it first run, like I said, I really missed him. I think there could have been, I really think, like, had he, you know, had they had him go away to the academy and come back, they maybe could have gone a different way with his character. He could have been less the miraculous miracle worker who saves the ship at the last moment, Wonder Boy kind of thing. You know, I think it could have been interesting just to see him grow up and really grow up. But I know that there's a great deal of sentiment out there that people were happy to not have the Wesley stories anymore.
Yeah. Because, like I said, there's really not much else he could do, and he's not even a Starfleet officer yet, just an acting one.
Right, right. But I think, you know, like, I mean, his mom went away for a year and came back. And so I think, you know, maybe had Wesley gone away for a year and come back, maybe they could have taken his character in new directions. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Doc? What do you think?
So, actually, Louis, I mean, you mentioned that he's not a Starfleet officer yet, but he is for all intents and purposes, right?
Oh, that's right, he was.
You know, as soon as they got him into the uniform, he's treated as if he's just a junior ensign. Now, I'm actually of the opinion that, although I wasn't a huge Wesley fan, I think it's better to have him on the show because it gives the writers options and it gives them the ability to, you know, produce different stuff. Now, that's a separate argument as to say when the writers wrote for Wesley, did they do anything that was any good? Because I think sometimes they didn't do anything that was very good. I mean, we're not big fans of the Dolphin in season 2, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But having him around gives the writer an option to produce a story with him in that could have been good, and you know, removing him loses.
Picard gets to settle some issues with some miners, and by the way, that's miners, not miners.
Mm-hmm.
They're even sending Picard a shuttle for the trip, but first he's got a very important thing to do. He's going to make Wesley run to the bridge to see him. Problem is, he called for him 14 seconds ago. What the hell took so long? Okay, maybe it was 10 minutes ago, but Wesley comes in, yes, sir, well, you know, huffing and puffing, and it seemed like he started breathing heavier as he had to explain.
Mm-hmm.
He seemed fine, he was just standing there, and all of a sudden, you know, I called for you to, well, no, excuse me, Mr. Crusher, no, sir, I'm just trying to explain, and I don't know what was causing that, but.
But, you know, I mean, in all fairness to Wesley, I think that if Captain Picard were, you know, on the case of any one of us, we might start to hyperventilate a little bit, too. So
that might be. That mm-hmm. might be true. That could be true. But why would they have called Picard instead of Wesley?
You mean the Academy?
Yeah.
But then he's still a minor. So they would have called his mum, maybe.
Well, if he's an acting ensign, then, you know, then technically he's under Picard's command, right? So I could see why they would route it through him.
Okay, that makes sense. I thought maybe, you know, there would be some privacy issues.
There's no privacy in the 24th century, Lou.
Oh, no. No. Like when Worf intercepts a message that Picard has a new heart coming to him.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
He has a what?
Anyway. But the miners are sending a shuttle. And I've always had this theory. Anytime anybody gets on a shuttlecraft or a runabout, there's a good chance they're screwed. And then they put them on this rinky-dink shuttle that has a captain of a mining shuttle. I mean, if I was Picard, quite honestly, I would have said, no, thank you. I'll be taking the El Baz over there or one of the other shuttles. I don't know if I would have gotten on board that.
Yeah, I don't know. Because, like, okay, so Han Solo is the captain of his ship. And that wasn't, you know, the size of the Enterprise or anything. That was basically, you know, he was basically hauling stuff from here to there. So it's understandable that this guy is, he's the captain of his ship. Humble though it may be.
Did she say Han Solo?
I did.
Oh my goodness.
Uh-oh. Am I not allowed to mention Star Wars?
Star what? That's crazy talk there. All right. So Picard is, what Picard is saying is, even if you're working with volatile chemicals that, you know, could kill us one day, mm-hmm. especially if you drop it now and you report to me ASAP. Is the Academy that bad also? Because I had a thought about it. It could be some pretty bad news from the future that I could be doing right now. Do you want to hear about it?
Sure.
Doc? You're quiet.
I do want to hear about your news for the future. Okay. But just before, when you were talking about, you know, Wesley leaving his experiment or his volatile material and running up, I mean, it's not as if he doesn't have... He has had this happen before, right? Where he left the nanites unlocked as he fell asleep. So if I were Picard, I really want him to take all the precautions before running up to the bridge.
It's right. True.
Right. But Captain, I've got volatile chemicals out.
Right, Ensign. Take your time.
And now, the Lou Trek Show is proud to present news from the future. Just because we ain't there yet doesn't mean it didn't happen.
An accident at Starfleet Academy has left hundreds dead in what officials call a complete lapse in good judgment and policymaking. An identified cadet, son of a Federation doctor, was working with some volatile chemicals when he was summoned to the Commandant's office. Previously warned that making a high-ranking official wait longer than 14 seconds won't go down well, the cadet became concerned he was taking too long to report to the office, leaving the chemicals on his desk when another cadet found them and threw them both down the laboratory sink. Why the Academy isn't using a replicator for disposal, officials won't comment on. Starfleet promises to launch an investigation into the incident, but first needs to replace several dead investigators as well as four Academy classes. Now, wouldn't that be a good time for the Borg or the Dominion to strike? Comments?
Very good. Very good.
Nicely done.
I enjoyed that.
Thank you.
And that was News from the Future. Check back often for more news from the future.
Okay, so before anyone could leave the ship, there's a distress call from Gamma Lama Gamelin 5, who has an unidentified spacecraft that is bombarding the planet with radiation, and they just can't figure out why the ship isn't answering. So,
you know, regarding this species, I'm willing to bet they invented the straw very, very early on in their civilization.
Really? And why is that?
Yes, why is that?
Because I don't think they'll be able to use a cup. Right? It seemed very impractical. Sometimes I don't quite know, you know, when you do see the aliens that have, like, really alien-y makeup, sometimes Star Trek, like, wanders into areas where you think, that's just not going to work.
Mm.
And certainly people that have effectively sewn lips, I don't quite see how it works.
I don't know. Melissa wanted to tell him the story about the handle face.
Well, you know. See, I think goes on is, I think there's like a bet in the costuming department sometimes, and it's, you know, how utterly ridiculous of a face can you come up with? Because faces are really all they have to work with, right? Because in Star Trek, everybody's human from the neck down. So, you know, I think it gets a little crazy sometimes, or somebody has a bad day, or, you know.
Can't eat. I mean, yeah. The handle face. Poor guy. He can't scream. He can't eat.
And who knows what happened in that evolutionary path? You just don't know.
Trip to the dentist is probably torture. Oh, my. Have to find another way in to their teeth. Okay. So, obviously, space is big. We've talked about space is big and why there are no other ships in the area. Mm-hmm. I mean, why would there be? Mr. Worf, are there any other ships in the area? Yes, sir. There are four. Let them handle it. Let's carry on.
But it'd be such a boring episode at that point, you know?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Because really, I hate to admit this, when Doc says he's going to be a downer on this show, I thought the scenes on the Enterprise were better than the scenes on the planet, but got that water. Just can't get to it. I don't know.
So, okay, is it worth revisiting and re-moaning about the fact that when you have a shuttle that can't go at warp speed, it literally cannot take you anywhere in the grand scheme of things?
And right.
You should not be using a non-warp shuttle rather than just warping a little bit, dropping the guys off, and then warping back within 20 seconds. Mm-hmm. This is the big problem whenever they have these shuttles. And then if you do look at the shuttle, they're not in the shuttle for very long before they crash, right? They crash within seconds of getting there because, you know, even though there aren't any cuts to suggest the passage of time, there's even the line of dialogue between the shuttle captain and Wesley about, you know, you do know how to use this, implying that they are just setting out. And how can they crash into a planet literally seconds away from the Enterprise without anyone noticing? I found that kind of contrived.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is a very fair point. I understand why the shuttles are necessary, because we know from other, you know, other parts of Star Trek that they're not supposed to be using warp drive within such an area of a system, right? I mean, they break that rule, but they have said it. Like, the rule is, like, I'm pretty sure we've been told that that's the case before. So you can understand how they would need to have these shuttles that would basically operate for the purpose of, like, interplanetary transport or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But now, and correct me, because maybe I'm wrong about this, but I was under the impression that they took off on the shuttle and then the Enterprise left and then they crashed. But they crashed while the Enterprise was still there?
No.
No.
The Enterprise took off quickly.
Okay. So the Enterprise did leave before they crashed?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. And it's interesting, you know, you say no, can't use warp within the solar system, but I do believe Captain Kirk hit warp drive in a Klingon warbird while he was about 40 feet from the ground in San Francisco, but
yeah, you know,
whatever. it depends on what the plot has, but
right.
So, go ahead.
And also, I mean, it's not as if on Star Trek Next Generation there is specifically a ship that can be split into two. One has a non-warp drive section that can sort stuff out, whereas the star drive can go and do its thing with all of the, you know, without posing risk to the main crew if you were to come across, I don't know, dangerous radiation levels.
Sure.
And whenever you come across this, I think I'm noticing it more. They're not splitting the ship, or they're not even referring to splitting the ship at any point.
Right.
Well, that's expensive, you know, to do.
Yeah, and it takes at least four minutes of the episode as well.
Right, exactly.
Okay, James, let me ask you a question. This always seems to happen. They're going along on thruster speed, it seems like. They weren't even, it's not warp, not even an impulse, because he said the port thruster module blew. Okay, so, I mean, why is it when they have a malfunction in a thruster or some system, they always crash land somewhere?
Okay, I can't answer that because it's stupid. the chances of you crashing into something in space is extremely remote. Even if you weren't able to, even if you weren't able to, for example, escape a gravity field of a planet, you've still got a chance of putting yourself into orbit and basically staying in orbit. And, you know, you wouldn't escape, but you'd stay in orbit and you'd kind of, you know, rotate around and you'd be safe.
Mm-hmm.
That's even if you have, even if you were near a planet. Now, the chances of you being near a planet are hugely remote as well. So I don't have a good answer. I honestly think that if Trek was a bit more like reality, A, you wouldn't come across any aliens, or at least it would be extremely infrequent when you came across planets and aliens. Mm. And then B, you certainly wouldn't be crash landing.
Okay.
Right.
But then, you know, where would the fun be, right?
Mm-hmm. And then you wouldn't have the opportunity to check out the cave systems on foreign planets. Walk through the desert.
Mm-hmm.
Feeling hot, hot, hot.
Mmm.
Okay.
Yes, I am, Lou, because I'm in Nebraska, and it's going to be like 100 degrees out today.
Yeah. So, you were around during the College World Series time.
What?
Well, we had the College World Series here in Omaha about a week and a half ago.
Oh, well, I guess I was, but I wasn't aware of it.
No, but what I'm saying is there were a few days it was just bitterly hot.
Yes, yes, there were.
So, welcome to Nebraska. Uh-huh. Okay, let's see here.
So, can we, if I may, can we talk about that scene when they do get down on the planet? Because I really like, I like what happens there between Picard and the other captain. And Wesley, and this is where I think Wesley's kind of the most annoying in this episode, because Wesley's darn near baiting that other captain, I think, at that point, you know. I mean, it comes off like he's slightly whiny, and he's slightly, oh, you should be listening to Captain Picard. He knows what he's talking about. You don't know what you're talking about. And I have to admit, like, I think that that's the part of the episode where I like Wesley the least. And I wonder if they're trying to show, like, some sort of character development for Wesley from that moment to the end of the episode, or I'm not really sure why they chose to do that. What did you guys think about that? You know what scene I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, every time he said something, it seemed to me they were setting that Durgo up as the heavy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everything from when he introduces himself as Captain Durgo, and it seemed like Wesley, there was no point to mention captain of a mining shuttle. No, when you're in command of any spacecraft, you're captain.
Right.
Why would he even say that? So yeah, it makes Wesley out to be a little jerk. But then again, they did make Durgo out to be pompous as well.
It's true. It's true. But I don't know that Wesley represents himself well in that scene. I mean, you just wouldn't really expect a Starfleet officer to address someone else that way, I think.
No.
And, you know, and Captain Picard is perfectly capable of taking care of himself, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think, too, it maybe just shows that filial relationship, I think. Or there's that paternal relationship going on from Captain Picard towards Wesley. And Wesley is kind of like, he's kind of like, a young man who's encountering somebody who's maybe insulting his dad and feels like he needs to step up.
That's a good point. That's what I was thinking as well, because, I mean, even in the shuttlecraft trip before the explosion or whatever, you know, mm-hmm. Captain back there, he better be tougher than he looks.
Mm-hmm.
Doc, your thoughts?
Okay, first of all, I don't actually like Durgo as a character. I think he's the boringest character. I think he's, well, in my notes, I've got no redeeming features, and I kind of think he's written in a very kind of caricaturish way. Mm-hmm. He's kind of pompous, and he's clearly going to be proven wrong throughout this episode. He's not on an arc to come back and to be redeemed.
Right.
At the same time, they write Picard as really not being able to do any wrong, and they write Wesley as basically a fanboy of Picard to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it is a little bit unfortunate. In particular, when you've got this thing about, you know, captain of a mining ship, and he goes, "Captain?" Now, you know, would that be any more acceptable if they happen to land on a planet of say, you know, 100,000 inhabitants, and there was the ruler of the planet, and they would go, ruler, you've only got 100,000 people living there. We represent 2.5 billion. I mean, it's not appropriate. And it's for someone who's supposed to be a Starfleet officer. And I know he's not been to the academy yet, but you don't learn not to be a jerk at the academy. You should know that beforehand. And right. I think it's just really, the episode's written to belittle the other guy and basically to make Picard look better.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Whilst Wesley's cheerleading.
Yeah, Wesley's cheerleading. There you go.
Boots check, tool belt check, hard hat check.
Up the builder, can we build it? Up the builder, yes we can.
Scoop, Muck and Lofty, and two times two. Leo and Wendy, join the crew. Bob and the team have so much fun. Working together, they get the job done.
Yeah.
Up the builder, can we fix it? Up the builder.
So the port thruster module blew.
I'm sorry, that banging. Give me just a second. I'll go take care of that. I'm not sure what she's doing out there, but I will go find out.
She's in a construction zone.
Do you get Bob the Builder in the US? Because that's English.
Yeah, we get Bob the Builder.
Excellent.
That's English?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh.
I don't know if they redubbed it for the US to make him not sound like an English dude. But Bob the Builder is English.
Oh. You know, I don't think I've ever watched that cartoon, but I know people who have.
Here, Bob the Builder, English version. Okay. Okay. Oh, that's cool. Where was I?
Okay. Let me ask a question, because I think we're about to get on to this. Okay. And I always like to ask these questions when they come up. So they've crash-landed on the planet, and they're trying to get away. And Picard says that they need to leave the shuttle because it's going to act like an oven.
Yeah.
Why would it act like an oven?
Metal.
Metal doesn't make it act like an oven.
What are you kidding?
Why would it
act like an oven? Well, because you would think that if a shuttle is insulated to, like, protect you from radiation, the incredibly cold temperatures of space, that it would shelter you from heat on a planet, wouldn't you think?
Yeah. So the thing usually is that if you're insulated, mm-hmm. you're not just insulated from getting, you know, cold in a cold area, but you're also insulated from getting hot in a hot area.
Right.
The fact that like your fridge is insulated, it does actually mean that if you have hot stuff in the fridge, it's going to, and you insulate it and you use that as a way of keeping it there, you're going to keep it hot. So mm-hmm. I thought that their logic was flawed in this case.
It could be that somehow the hull of the ship was so damaged that the insulating ability was gone. I don't know.
That is true. And when I actually rewatched it earlier today, I did notice that there were two gaping holes and they were losing some stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's very likely that, it is, I can give them a pass there. The other thing though is, because they did go from something like 500 million kilometers to zero in about a minute or so. And despite a lot of the systems being down, they must have had good inertial dampness. Otherwise they would have been soup on the back of the, back of the shuttle's door.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Or in this case, on the floor. But back to your first thing, though, I would say it would be insulated if they had airflow in the ship. But if there's no airflow in the ship, eventually things are going to start heating up in the desert from the outside in.
True.
Not
convinced. If the hull is damaged.
If the hull is breached, sure.
Yeah.
So let's say it
but
was.
If the hull is not breached.
Go ahead. If it was in perfect tact.
Yeah, if it's in perfect tact, then I would imagine that one of the main criteria of a spaceship is that it wouldn't lose its heat because you want to walk around at, 90 degrees Fahrenheit or whatever it is, and the outside temperature is at absolute zero. So you don't want to lose your temperature, and there's a huge temperature gradient there. Right. In the same way that if you get close to a sun, you don't want to go up to like 4,000 degrees very quickly. So naively, I'm assuming that a ship is going to be very well insulated. And if that's true, the fact that it's crashed on a planet doesn't mean it's not well insulated. And if it is well insulated, then it doesn't act like an oven. I mean, the oven is the opposite of insulated. There's no insulation in any oven.
Right.
Well, that's not true. I mean, that's clearly not true. But, you know what I mean? You should keep your internal temperature if you're a well insulated machine.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. Because I wrote down they find a Class M planet that's got a mean temperature, and I don't know what a mean temperature is, except for a temperature that's pissed off, of 55 degrees Celsius or 131 degrees Fahrenheit for us over here in Nebraska. And I'd start complaining at 80 degrees Fahrenheit. So I can't imagine 131.
No. It looked very, very hot.
Yes.
And unfortunately, it looked like it had been filmed, I don't know, around the same region as we might be going somewhere in a couple of weeks, Lou. So
yeah.
Bring your shorts.
That's a very good point. I was just thinking, what's it going to be like in Las Vegas in the desert?
Yeah.
Let's hope our Uber cars are well insulated. Okay, so the three guys find themselves on planet Hell with a very strong resemblance of the El Mirage dry lake bed in San Bernardino County by Los Angeles. So, and they have no water. So basically, for a while, they're literally the Kazon.
Right. And of course, Picard is shocked that he has no emergency supplies.
Yeah.
Well, now, question though. So does this shuttle, do they have replicator technology?
Yes, it was broke.
It was broken.
Yes. It was damaged beyond repair.
So they can't just replicate themselves some emergency supplies?
No. No, they would have thought of that.
You think so.
They didn't even have any. Okay, so he's saying that those little bags of water, he couldn't store about 7 of them, or maybe a few candy bars or protein bars or something that they use as rations that Chief O'Brien really loves.
Right, that's right.
But wait, isn't right at the beginning of the episode, right? I think two people are at fault here. Geordi gave the ship the all clear.
Mm-hmm.
And surely it must include some kind of safety provision, including supplies. But also the Worf's at stake here because he can't guarantee the safety of the captain by him being put onto a ship that's unsafe. So when Picard finally gets back, do you think those two are... How do you think their year-end appraisal is going to go?
See, I think they're going to have a staff meeting when he gets back. You know.
Hold on now. Actually, he did. Yeah, you're right. He did give it a once over. But what he said is he can't guarantee its comfort. But the thing about it is what happens later when Geordi gets his hands on a few thrusters? One of them breaks. So, Geordi. I think Geordi. It's a good thing Geordi has people under him to do the work. Because if Geordi had to actually do the engineering work himself, I think they'd be in trouble. I think Geordi's a better manager than an actual worker.
I've seen evidence that he's not a people person at all.
Yeah, I was just going to say, he's not really a very good manager. Brockway, anyone?
Yeah. Well, that's easy to do. Bark to Brock, whatever they called it.
Yeah.
Oh, and by the way, Doc, I'm looking at the Las Vegas temperatures right now. Today is projected to be 106, and it goes up to July 30th. It's hovering around between 105 and 108 Celsius.
You guys are staying at the Rio, though, right?
It's not 108 Celsius.
Farenheit.
No. Fahrenheit.
Yeah, Fahrenheit.
But you guys are staying at the Rio, right?
No.
Oh, you're not staying at the Rio.
No.
Where are you staying?
God, what's it called? Can't think of the name of it, but it's off the north end of Las Vegas, a cannery? Canary? I don't know, something canary? Like that.
Okay.
Because it was cheaper. I mean, yeah. With my wife being a diamond member in the Caesars properties, which include the Rio, Harrah's, Bally's, the rates were just too high during that time frame.
Okay. Both times that I've been, I've always stayed at the Rio, so there was really no reason to go outside until right. It was evening. And it is much more comfortable in the evening.
Yeah. Yeah, and we did stay at the Rio back in March. And okay. So we were in the high tower, and the higher tower, that is. And I'd look out our window, and you could see that zip line. People were, all hours of the day and night, or not night, but after a certain time. But still, you get on that thing, and you just zip down the zip line, you know, several hundred feet above the earth. Mm-hmm. And they kept asking me if I want to try it. And I'm like, no, I don't want to put the weight limit to the test. No, thank you. Because in my luck, I'd wind up in the 22nd floor of the building next to us. You know, in somebody's room, you know. Hi, do you mind if I drop in? So anyway.
Nice.
Yeah, actually. Okay, so let's see here. What do you guys think about it's kind of interesting that Picard thinks to do an arrow on the ground, point in the direction to where they went. However, it is ingenious. However, did you notice when they were started walking, they deviated to the right of the arrow?
And they were about 10 degrees out.
And they just kept going worse.
Yep. Absolutely.
So,
you know, I did not notice that. I have to admit, I did not notice.
So what they should have done is continually made arrows as they went along.
Right. But you can't just scratch an arrow in the sand because there's wind.
Right. Right. No, it was pieces of metal that he put down.
Right.
Mm. Captain Durgo, stand here and wait for the relief team to come find us and tell them we're in that cave. Or, you know, if one of them falls, you know, this is morbid, but one of them ends up dying in the sand, just place the body and put the arms out into an arrow.
As long as nobody comes along to eat the corpse, you're probably okay.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. We didn't see any birds flying around, no vultures or anything.
No.
Doesn't mean there aren't any on that moon.
It's true.
Tell me, Doc, this is going to be our moment of being schooled, if you don't mind.
Okay.
Yeah, he loves it when I do that.
Let me get warmed up.
Okay.
Go on.
Get your books out, kids, because Dr. Roberts is about to school ya.
How could you have a Class M environment on a moon?
What? That's not a valid question. What's wrong with that?
Why is there no breathable oxygen on our moon, then?
Okay, there's no breathable oxygen on our moon because the moon is too small to keep an atmosphere. So it doesn't have enough gravitational pull to keep an atmosphere. Mm-hmm. So you can't have a planet half our size and still have an atmosphere. It doesn't have enough pull to keep it in, and it will just disappear. So when they say stuff about Class M, all they're saying is that, you know, it has to have a breathable atmosphere. It has to be, I assume there are limitations on the gravity as well and stuff like that. And yeah, but the fact that our moon is a lump of rock doesn't mean that all moons need to be a lump of rock. So there would be nothing stopping let's just assume for a second that, you know, the Earth was 50 times bigger than it is. It may have a moon the size of what our Earth is now, and that moon may have a breathable atmosphere. So the classification of it, whether it's a moon or a planet, is merely just an indication of which body it rotates around, whether it rotates around the sun or whether it rotates around another body rotating around the sun. It doesn't say anything about whether it's appropriate to live on.
Yeah, because I was going to ask you, I mean, it's got an atmosphere, it's got ground, it's got clouds. Why do they call it a moon and not just a planet?
it'll be rotating around the planet.
Ah.
Right.
Okay.
Which probably makes it harder to live on, because you're going to have much more, you're likely to have more deviation right in the summer and, sorry, in terms of the extreme of temperatures. So if you think when we have our seasons, mm-hmm. you know, if we go from cold to warm, if you can imagine that if we're rotating around another body and we're far out from that, you could have a much more drastic seasons by us being closer and then further away from the sun because we're rotating around the body.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, but other than that, I don't see any reason why there would be a problem with us being a moon.
Hmm. Do you think maybe that moon was inhabited at one time?
Well, okay. That's what's a little frustrating because we know that, so you have this body of water in this cave and it's protected by a force field. So you kind of have want to assume that something intelligent put it there. But we're never really told it. And it's really more of a plot device, I guess, than anything of interest.
Hmm. Yeah, it makes sense. And maybe they had global warming and they had to get off the moon.
Maybe.
Now, I never can quite get my head around what this exact force field is and why it's there. And the best I can come up with is that, you know, Wesley and the crew just didn't find the coin-operated kind of button to the side where you had to put in four quarters and then it would drop the force field. You can get your water and then that's it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's really the best I've come up with. It's a vending machine.
That's fascinating. Because I, for the life of me, I can't figure out why somebody would want to put a force field around a fountain.
Well, I suppose, I mean, I can understand that. Because if your water supply is really limited and there's competition for resources and you don't want somebody else drinking up all your water, then I can understand why someone would put a force field around it, just like you might protect a well. But we don't know any of those things. We don't know if there was ever anybody there or, you know, you just have to guess.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's go back to the planet with the ship in orbit. We find out that it's a garbage ship and it's leaking radiation. So, but it's no problem, you know, although we can't really tractor beam it away because, well, we'll irradiate ourselves. So let's attach a few construction modules and it'll just get there on its way. But except for it has to go through that crazy little asteroid belt. Take it away, Doc.
Okay, there's nothing really to take away here. But, okay, the big problem here is that they're in a hurry. So the first thing you should do if you're in a hurry is you should just put it in this garbage scow into a safe location and then come back and deal with it later. There's no reason why they had to take it all the way through to the final solution. They could have just moved it to one side and everyone would be happy. You know, people are pretty good at predicting how bodies are going to move in space. It's not that hard a problem just to move it to one side. In particular, most of the solar systems we know about, you do have this idea of it being like a disc shape. So everything is rotating around the sun and on the same plane. If you just push it upwards, so it's not headed into the sun, but it's just headed out of the solar system, it's not going to hit anything.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first thing. Actually, there are so many things. Asteroid fields. Asteroid fields are not that dense. They're really not. They are not dense. The chances of you pushing something for an asteroid field and it hitting something in the asteroid field is minute. I mean, we've sent probes out to the outside of the solar system. They all went through the asteroid field. None of them got hit on the asteroid field. None of them have deflected dishes. It's not that tricky to go through an asteroid field.
Mm-hmm.
You'd be lucky to hit something in an asteroid field. And then eventually, look, I'll talk about the stuff of why they need to actually have a tractor beam on it. If you're moving in space, you don't need a tractor beam. You don't need to be pulling the thing along. It's moving. It's moving on its own inertia. You don't have to be tagged to it. They even bring this up in the battle, right? in season one, where they'll track the beam in the Stargazer, and they say, "So, well, Riker, didn't you learn anything about basic Newtonian mechanics? Turn off the tractor beam." And he kind of, with a sad head, turns off the tractor beam. Now, 3 years later, he really should have remembered what the card told him. He does not need to be dragging this thing around.
Okay.
Anyway.
Yes, there are all sorts of problems with this other story. And I thought, honestly, we could have done without it, I think. Other than we just needed an excuse for the Enterprise to be busy long enough for Picard and Wesley to have this bonding experience. But they easily could have just been far away, and it just simply took them that long to get there.
I think that's absolutely correct. And I also think, as well, the story of them landed on the planet falls into that same category as well.
Mm.
You know, what the story is, they want to have the moments between Picard and Wesley so that they can, you know, they can have that interaction.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to do that, unfortunately, what they've come up with is, well, how do we get them together? Or why not an accident? Well, because, you know, they'll be saved by the crew. Oh no, make it a shuttle accident. Oh, well, where's the other ship? Make it far away. And so I think that they are really, to a certain extent, I think they're trying to paint themselves into a corner, and they're painting themselves into a corner with wide strokes of stupid.
Mm,
sure.
And okay, it's fine. I'm not, you know, I shouldn't moan about this kind of thing. But, you know, no one leaves this episode and takes away that, that the main storyline was about, you know, can you cart off the rubbish bin out to the sun on that planet?
Right.
Really, it's not about that at all.
No.
I think they could have been cleverer.
Mm-hmm. I think that's completely fair. Like, you know, again, for me, when I think of this episode, or, you know, when you're just remembering it and you haven't seen it recently, I remember... pretty much the only thing I remember is I remember the interactions between Wesley and Picard. And even if it had just been, if they had gotten on a slow moving shuttle and had to fly all the way to the academy and somehow they'd had these conversations, I think I'd have been okay with that, especially watching it the first time. Cause I so loved the character of Captain Picard. I was a kid and I loved the relationship between Wesley and Picard. Like, that's all I would have needed. But I think that in all fairness, there's a lot of, I can't argue with you on your criticisms of the story.
Okay. Since they took the Enterprise through this asteroid belt and the deflector is pushing asteroids out of their way.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't that send asteroids in new trajectories now?
Yep. Absolutely.
So now somebody could have a problem.
Why? Why is that? You're assuming it's going to be. You're going to assume that pushing it out of the way is going to be pushed out of orbit.
Yeah. And or, you know, heading towards a planet.
Yeah. No, sure. But we've discussed this before, and I'll mention it again. bodies that are in rotation around a central, you know, a central kind of like celestial mass, they are stable under small perturbations. Now, what that means is that you can push them a little, and it's not gonna mean they're gonna fly out of their orbit.
Mm. So they're still in the same path, just slightly over to the right now.
Yeah. So it basically means that in order to knock something out of an orbit, you have to hit it very, very hard.
Okay.
So it is that, and it's not that you hit it hard, and then you have to then wait and then hit it. It's also not very cumulative either. So there's this idea that if you were to hit it a little and then something else hits it a little again, all of these things build up, and that's not really true. The way that it works is that you have to overcome a lot of potential energy in order to get out of the orbit. So everything wants to be in an orbit, which is frankly why when you look around this, everything is in an orbit. You know, if things didn't want to be in an orbit, the moon would have crashed down to the Earth a long time ago. And it's not just that the moon hasn't got round to crash into the Earth. And the moon's been hit by a lot of stuff, right? You just have to look at the moon and you can see how much the moon's been hit.
Yeah.
The fact is that, you know, by their nature, orbits are stable. to small perturbations, which means you've got to whack it hard to get it out of that orbit.
Is it basically the concept of escape velocity, or does that only pertain to... Because I know we use that term, like there's a certain escape velocity that you have to reach in order, for example, to get off the Earth. Does that apply to all other orbits as well? Or
actually, very similar. So escape velocity is how much energy you need to give yourself in order to overcome the full potential whirl of a planet.
Okay.
And the orbit one is, again, you have to give yourself energy to overcome this little bit of a local minimum of potential. So it's exactly the same thing. You have to give yourself enough energy to escape the orbit.
Okay.
And it is, you know, things want to be in an orbit. Things don't want to fall in, and things don't want to escape. Anyway, sorry, Lou, you were asking about, but conceptually, I suppose, if you did give it enough welly, then you could have knocked that planet out. And then, that asteroid out, and it might have then looped around and hit someone in the face in 200 years' time and started a war. That is potentially correct.
Wesley picks up some radiation readings in the mountain ahead. I did kind of like the discussion he had with Picard, you know, what could be there as they're trying to analyze what these energy readings are.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, no comment on that. Okay, the construction modules that Geordi puts on, like I indicated earlier, of course, one of them breaks off, and now the only thing they could do is tractor beam it through the asteroid field themselves. Why? What's causing the radiation to even get out of that garbage ship? Wouldn't it be insulated?
I think the best you can say here is it's not particularly well insulated.
Mm-hmm.
But the Enterprise should be well insulated against radiation in general, right? So I suppose the best you can do here is just say that it's a large amount of radiation that is such a huge, vast amount compared to what you'd get by flying into the corona of the sun, which they have done, that it manages to get through.
Yeah, and I think it's fair to say that whoever put all that garbage in that ship, they weren't really trying to deal with it. They were just trying to pass it on.
And actually, memories of the Maison?
Yeah. Maylon. The Maylon.
The Maylons. Mm-hmm. Maylons.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, I mean, with the ships, shields, and everything, the radiation still gets through to the Enterprise, and they're 1 minute away from lethal exposure, or really like 10 seconds away from lethal exposure. So what does that mean? They're going to begin dying off one by one, starting with the people in the back of the ship, or does everybody die at the same time?
We've had this discussion before, Lou. So the issue of lethal exposure at a certain point is something that is not valid, not true. And people, you know, some people will get sick and die beforehand. Some people will get sick and die afterwards. And the fact that you go right up to lethal exposure and then don't quite get there doesn't mean you're not going to die.
Right.
So it's another one of these. Well, what they're trying, they want to put a kind of like a ticking clock into the episode in addition to the other ticking clock that's going to make sure you can go and rescue Picard. And I think that's just been a little bit sloppy with lethal exposures. I mean, okay. People will understand that people will start dying and it wraps up the tension.
Right.
Okay. All right. Well, Wesley starts to open up to Picard about how he's worked hard to make his father proud of him, or make Picard proud of him. And he's determined to get that water. But first, Durgo gives it a try. Now, obviously, the thing attacks Durgo, and it attacked a phaser at first. We went around that. But when it attacked Durgo, it encased him in some kind of silicon, maybe? Mm-hmm. Do you think he was dead instantly? Or wouldn't it have been kind of weird if he actually saw his eyes wiggling as he was actually dying because there's no breath? No air available?
I'd like to think he died instantly.
Well, yeah, that'd be nicer, more comforting. But why? Why did he die? Why couldn't Wesley get out his trusty Boy Scout knife and poke a hole in there and let him breathe.
Because, okay, here's my theory. My theory is, like, so it looks to us like he's just encased in it, but my theory is that he wasn't just encased, that he was almost, like, petrified by it. So it wasn't just encasing him, but it turned everything into whatever that material is. So yeah, he died instantly.
Hmm. Okay. Like those people that are laying forever on a moon somewhere.
No, not exactly. Like, I don't know. Help me out, James. You know what I mean, right?
Sorry, what are the people lying on the moon or something?
That's a Voyager. Voyager episode where Harry Kim ends up on this planet.
Oh, you mean the dead people thingy?
Yes, the dead right. people thing.
No, not that. No, I think it's just a... Well, unfortunately, I've got, you know, the term that I have to describe what happened is some type of, you know, extremely brutal bubble wrapping of the individual. But I would generally assume that he would have been killed kind of immediately. I think it's a much, much darker episode if this guy is just about to live and Wesley has to see whether or not he can either cut into him or leave him to,
you know, okay.
To die.
Well, if you want darker episode, let's call Veron T. Disruptor.
True. But also, you know, it kind of reminds you of that episode, Heart of Stone, that's coming up in DS9 pretty soon, mm-hmm. where Kira is slowly encased in some sort of crystal stone thing. And Odo thinks she's going to die. We haven't gotten to it yet, but it's coming up soon.
Mm. Okay. All right, so the Enterprise arrives to look for the shuttle after they were successfully able to get the garbage scow, or whatever it's called, away. It was kind of interesting as Picard was, I guess you could say he was dying, right? Because, mm-hmm. you know, and he starts singing the... whatever. The one him and Robert was singing in Family.
Right. Well, I think he was going into shock, pretty much, is what was happening.
Right. Yes. And then he tells a story about Boothby.
Yep.
So, love Boothby.
Okay, now for me, and the most heartbreaking line, I think, is when he looks at Wesley, and he basically tells him he's so jealous because... Wesley's adventures are just beginning.
Yeah.
That for me, that's the moment in the episode where I start to tear up.
Yes. Yeah. Because, I mean, we're all, you know, we're not at the beginning anymore. We're halfway through this. And like right. Picard even says, you know, I'm even becoming aware that there are fewer days ahead than behind. So mm-hmm. it's fascinating. Well, it happens to us all. So, but Wesley finds a way to get to the water. He just manipulates the energy field and stops it just before it bubbles him mm-hmm. and is able to save Picard.
Yay!
Mm-hmm. Did anyone really think he was in jeopardy? Just like when we watched The Year of Hell, that poor Voyager was getting slaughtered to pieces little bit by little bit, but we knew that if they didn't make it, there's nothing next week. So, okay. Is there anything we missed, Doc? Because I know we have to get through this quick.
No, let us give Melissa enough time to do her final thoughts, and then we are pretty much there.
Well, then it's now time for our final thoughts on this episode on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being the worst and 5 being the best. Melissa, go for it.
Okay, this episode makes me cry every time I see it. So that last scene between Wesley and Picard is emotionally impactful, even in rewatch. So I'm going to have to give this episode 4 stars, which I realize is being very generous, given the... poor story work in much of the rest of it, the fact that really nobody cares about the B-plot. But I still love this episode. This is an important episode to me because I consider it to be just really one of the beautiful moments in the story arc, not just of Wesley, but I think even more importantly in the character development of Captain Picard. So 4 stars for me.
Cool enough, Doc.
Okay. I'm going to come in low, I'm afraid. I'm coming in lower than that. I don't know. I don't think that the story that they have at the core that they want to tell regarding Wesley and Picard is wrapped up well enough way it deserves. I think we've seen other Star Trek episodes that, you know, do have that as its nexus, that they are able to put something around it. And sometimes they don't put anything around it and they allow that story to stand on its own. I just don't think that they do enough in this episode to make it kind of good in my mind. I'm not a Wesley hater, so I'm not cheering as he's disappearing. Overall, I find it very hard to give anything above a 2, I'm afraid. That felt bad.
You know, it's fair. It's fair. It's all sentiment. It's all sentimentality for me, I think, with this one. Mm-hmm. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to be brief. I really, the planet stuff, it was very predictable. As soon as they got on the shuttle, we knew that something was going to happen. I didn't need the previews to tell me that. I did kind of like the radiation stuff. Now, that was kind of interesting, even if it doesn't make any sense. But there was an element of danger, and Riker took charge. And one thing I didn't say in this episode, we didn't say, is I kind of like when Riker takes command. Riker's in charge. He's running the ship. I like it when he's running the ship. He's a lot more mature in the captain's seat than he is in the right seat. And so I do like the Riker storyline, and this kind of was a Riker storyline. What's he going to do without the captain? Stuff on the planet, I thought they put Wesley to good use. I think he kind of saved the day again, but this time it was a little more mature than usual, and it was in a different way. He did take command of Durgo, and he was able to, although he couldn't stop him, he still saved Picard, and now it's off to a new adventure for him. So I'm not as quite as down as the Doctor, so I thought this is more of a 3 because of the radiation aspect, and Riker had to step up and save the day as well. So I'm coming in at a 3. Okay, Melissa, it's time for you to go. So I want to thank you for coming on, and we will see you again for In Theory.
Yes.
And that's going to be somewhere in probably November, because now I'm looking at the schedule and I see I've scheduled people for August 6th when we're actually in Las Vegas. So, Lou, what you do. So look forward to you seeing you then. I will see you probably before then.
Yes.
I'm coming on for Visionary.
That's right. It will be great to have you. And James, it was so very nice to meet you. And you will be coming on Upper Pylon 2 at some point very soon as well, correct?
I believe so. I think that, so unfortunately, I was going to be coming on for Defiant, but I couldn't make that recorded and there was some scheduling issues. So I got bumped into the future. I think I've been bumped for family business.
Okay.
But I will have to confirm that, or at least someone somewhere is taking care of that. It's something
scheduling. Like. Our scheduling is all the good doctor, and he does an excellent job with it. So I'm sure he'll take care of you.
You know what's funny about this real quick is I had wondered for years why you called Matt Admiral Hansen, Admiral Matt Hansen. And it wasn't until we did the Best of Both Worlds that I realized why you were calling him Admiral. And so that's neither here nor there. But I am looking forward to getting on for the Magnificent Ferengi. So I guarantee I'm going to be looking for that one as well.
Okay. Very good.
Stripped of her Betazoid powers.
I don't sense anything.
Crippled by the devastating loss.
It's time I accept the truth, Captain, and resign as ship's counselor.
Helpless during an urgent call to duty.
We need you.
I'm absolutely lost. You have to do something.
There's brain damage.
I don't know what to do.
Powerless in the face of destruction on Star Trek, The Next Generation.
All right, everybody. So join us next week as we review episode number 10 for season 4. and that is called The Loss with a new guest. I won't say any more. Take care, everyone, and good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.